This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about sexuality as a factor in mental health. And we're rejoined by previous co-host, who you'll recognise the voice as the artist previously known as Annie Harris, who is now called Erin Emphis, following a fun name change relating to them now identifying as non-binary. And it's worked out really well that we've got to record this together, because I know sexuality and its intersections with mental health is something you're really passionate about. And to set the scene, we've got some info from Rethink Mental Illness that we're going to read out together, like old times.
Very exciting. Being LGBT plus does not automatically mean you will have mental health issues, but you may be more likely to develop mental health issues. A review of studies on mental health issues in the LGBT plus community found the following. Gay and bisexual men are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide across their lifetime than the rest of the population. Lesbian and bisexual women also have higher prevalence of suicidality.
LGBT plus people are 2.5 times more likely to develop depression and anxiety as their counterparts in the rest of society.
67% of trans people have experienced depression in the previous year, and 46% had thought about ending their life.
And also from Stonewall's Prescription for Change report, they found out of all the most common sexual identity groups, bisexual people most frequently have mental health problems, including depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicidality.
The reasons why there are higher rates of mental health issues among LGBT plus people are complex. There are many experiences that LGBT plus people will have to deal with as a minority community, such as stigma, prejudice, and discrimination.
And so there's a lot of information there. Much of those stats are indeed very sobering. We've talked about sexuality previously on the podcast with Sean Leonard, if people want to have further listening on this topic. It's something that we both care a lot about. And it's a tricky conversation to have because I think there's so much to it. Like it said in the information there, because you identify as part of one of these groups doesn't mean you then automatically are going to experience mental health problems. But there can be a lot of discrimination and other factors that make that more likely.
I agree.
And particularly when it mentions around like the stigma and discrimination, we talk about those parallels all the time. So then if you're having discrimination because of your sexuality or your gender identity, plus stigma for a mental illness you might be diagnosed with, then it becomes a real web of what's contributing to what and how does it all escalate.
Yeah, I'm almost like surprised when I meet a queer person or a gender non-conforming person and I, you know, make a comment about trauma or mental health and they, you know, they imply that they've got no mental health issues. I'm like, wow, like I'm really impressed for you. Like, how have you managed to escape that or avoid that, if you like? One of my like sort of ice-breaking conversation starters at the moment, which is probably a bit strange now I reflect on it out loud on a podcast in front of hundreds and thousands, but one of it is like how queer people are all traumatized. Like we're all just like traumatized little babies, basically. They just all need a bit of extra love. And like I've said that to a few, like I've said that a lot. And in like mostly queer settings, everyone's like, oh yeah, fuck yeah, absolutely. Like I relate to that on a really high level, or like mood, you know. And then some people are like, yeah, no, I don't know. Like maybe like one or two of them maybe out of that have just been like, yeah, no, I don't relate to that. And I'm, it's like in Anchorman when the dog eats a whole wheel of cheese and he's like, I'm not even mad. I'm just impressed. Like, you know, I just don't know how, I don't know how you could avoid it, you know, from the way that people are treated in 2021. And, you know, previously, it just boggles me that you can escape unscathed from that these days.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying of the phrasing is strange to say out loud, but I can see what you mean, that sometimes a lack of acceptance can affect people's emotional growth. You know, if you're still battling for the people really close to you to accept a very core and important part of how you identify, then that can really make it harder to sort of move on. I almost think of, is this showing my age? I think of it almost like the weakest link a little bit. Sometimes there's things that you go through in your life where you kind of, you want to bank it, you know, and that's the same with like your mental health. you might come to a diagnosis that can be very powerful to you. You get that, and that can be a lot of progress in terms of them being able to access specific support, know what's happening with you, have something that you can research and a label that's shorthand for an important part of you. But then if people aren't accepting of what's going on in your mental health, then that can kind of keep you in that like vague space of you can't be like, okay, well, that's what I've got, and now on to the next thing.
Yeah, I saw a therapist once that referred to me as having like a bit of an arrested development. And I was like, oh, I love that TV show. He was like, no. It's like, have we ever talked about attachment theory on Mental Podcast by any chance?
Not much. Strangely, we've talked about it more on Dating Games.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I'm just wondering, because it's attachment theory, right? So like we don't get to make those connections, those solid partnerships, relationships. We don't have those like role models and those positive influences to attach to and have that secure attachment to. It's amazing how attachment can affect mental health and the way that we perceive things later in life.
Yeah, definitely. Well, again, it's part of a fundamental part of growing up, learning how to have appropriate and grown-up relationships with people. And if you're still trying to battle to repair some of the relationships with family or people close to you when you're young, that can keep you in somewhat maybe like a turbulence we'd associate with teenagehood. You know, it can have these additional shockwaves for you. But we will go into that in more depth with our wonderful guests this week, who are both from The Bottoming Podcast, which is a show all about hitting rock bottom with your mental health and the hope and recovery that can be found from there. You like the pun?
I like the pun very much. When I read that on the brief, I was like, nice.
Yeah, and I like that they go for this dual approach, you know, that they're trying to battle discrimination around mental health, but also sexuality and all the places that those two can come together. I also did want to finish up talking in this intro with some progress that's happened in recent years, because sometimes I think we can forget how recent a lot of the progress towards equality when it comes to sexuality has been. And so I've got a few bits I picked out from, the last few years. So first, acknowledgement of LGB families in the school curriculum came in only last year as part of the same reforms that introduced mental health education. And that was something that I remember there was a lot of controversy around what that meant, but much of it simply did come down to if there was a lesson about families, then there would be efforts made to include families representative of those in the school, as opposed to one definition of what a family is. And it makes a lot of sense with some other stats I'll read in terms of same-sex marriage. So that was legalised here in Britain in 2014, and this was only extended to Northern Ireland last year. In 2015, the Republic of Ireland was the first country in the world to vote for same-sex marriage to be legalised. And I've got a quote from drag queen Panty Bliss, who many people, myself included, saw as the figurehead of that referendum. "I am drunk on yes. It's not that Ireland has changed today, but that Ireland has confirmed the change that we already knew had happened." And I think that sums up some of the things we talk about in today's episode, in that so much progress is being made in terms of recognising the diversity that comes within sexuality and the distinctive experiences people can have that can impact their mental health. But it's about education and rights catching up with the conversations that a lot of people are having.
Correct. Yeah, that's really nice. That's a really nice quote. I hadn't heard that before. I had heard of Panty Bliss. That gives me happy feels.
Good. I am obsessed. There's a whole movie about that with Panty at the centre of it. If anyone wants to go look at that, it's called Queen of Ireland. So thank you so much for talking it through with me, Erin. It's always great to catch up, even on a sweltering day where I've literally just had a costume change to shorts mid-recording.
Yeah, I'm just t-shirt and gym shorts, and that will be me for the rest of the day.
All right, so with all that, we'll get into the episode with Brendan and Matthew in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. As a show that thrives on conversation, it's our pleasure to be partnering with the Michelle Thomas Method, a pioneering format for picking up a new language.
Michelle Thomas designed this brilliant audio-only approach around his belief that language learning should be fun and stress-free. So there's no homework, no vocab lists, or trying to memorize everything. You can just sit back, relax, and enjoy the process.
By breaking language down into logical chunks and using seamless memory techniques, I've been so impressed with how quickly I'm picking up new phrases and finding ways to build sentences in French.
Plus, you can learn anytime on your phone or your computer. So I've been making time in the evenings before bed. And then I'm also so excited to practice and share what I've learned with my Spanish friends.
Yeah. And our listeners can start their language journey with 25% off at michellethomas.com. That's michelthomas.com with code HEALTH at the checkout to claim 25% off any course. And there are so many languages to choose from.
The Michelle Thomas Method. Learn a language for good.
You've probably heard us talk about the work of Grass & Co., an independent business based in the UK that is committed to crafting the very best wellbeing products.
These include bath salts, candles and sleep pillow sprays that incorporate natural scents and botanicals and are all ethically sourced. They also have a range of CBD balms and oils that are batch tested to make sure they are THC free.
And we've been diligently using the samples they sent us. Most recently, I've been using the Rest Pillow Spray a lot. This light and comforting scent includes geranium, rosemary and frankincense to mist over your bed and leave it smelling fresh, cozy and ready for sleep. Because let's be honest, we need all the help we can get in this hot weather. To try their products out for yourself, use code HEALTH at grassandco.com/health for 25% off plus free shipping as one of our listeners. That's grassandco.com/health with code HEALTH, and those details are in the episode description.
Grass & Co., a life inspired by nature.
Love it. You pronounced it like I do. Grass.
I did.
So my name's Brendan. As far as I can remember, I've been very anxious and quite a down person, but I never really knew that it was kind of something that should be looked at. I just thought it's part of my character. I just thought I was sad and scared all the time. But I think it was very much connected to sexuality because I grew up in quite a religious household. So in terms of there being those themes around not being gay and things like that, that repression did have an impact on me. There's always that thing with the chicken and the egg, whether you're kind of born with a depressed nature or whether it's biology, genetics, and then also life experiences where certain things happen to trigger those things. So I think that definitely had a part to play in it. And then I did always think it was circumstantial. So when I moved away from home, I thought, oh yeah, this will be the cure because it's clearly just the household that's, you know, making me feel so bad. And then it just gradually got worse and it didn't change. Then it got to a point in, I think it was 2018, just crescendo of mess, and had a bit of a break, a mental break, and was put on the waiting list for therapy, got medication, and kind of started my journey out of it after that. And I will say that on medication was the first time that I felt normal, for want of a better word, or just not scared shitless. I was just kind of, can I swear on this?
Yeah,
just not scared shitless. So it was kind of a revelation. And then since then, I've kind of been like, okay, well, what else can I try and do to make myself feel the best that I can be and just veer away from those feelings that I had when I was younger? I did an interview a couple of days ago. One of the questions was, what age would you go back to if you could? And I was just like, I don't want to go back to any age. I'm just really looking forward to just, you know, what's next. And I'm excited for the future, which is something that I never used to have. I was never excited for the future. I would have a balance system where as soon as something good would happen, I'd anticipate something bad happening. And when something bad happened, I'd kind of reassure myself by anticipating something good. So it kind of a reward system in a way. And it was really bizarre. But yeah, I was always kind of negative and thought we're all going to die before we went on holidays and things like that. And I think that's the short version. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And even something you said very early on, I want to pick up on around the kind of backflips we can do to rationalize this behavior. So you have the combination of not only a lot of this being normal for you because it had been so long term, but you also had an excuse for everything. And I find that very much the same with my experience of depression. When I look back, it's crazy to think how extreme some of my behavior was, and yet I had an excuse for every single thing, a different excuse every time, which of course makes so much less sense than what I now know this was all connected. There is a through line here.
Completely. Yeah, I was writing about some high health anxiety I had when I was younger, and well, up until about whenever I got my medication. And I still have it a bit now, but I was kind of chronicling these different points in my life where I just, you know, assumed I was going to die because I found certain things wrong with me. And it is almost like a justification system where as long as you're looking for it, you're always going to find it. Mm-hmm. And so I was just constantly like looking for lumps and things like that. And it's just, I drove myself in circles. And in a way, like if certain things would be found, like I had Bell's palsy when I was 17, which is kind of facial paralysis of half of your face. And so I used that. That was like another justification for myself. I was like, yeah, well, something's definitely going to be wrong with me. And so as soon as these continue to happen, I just lash onto it and say, okay, well, this is why I should keep worrying. This is exactly why I'm right to think the way I am. And therapy was the best way for me to kind of get out of my head in that way and realize that all those thoughts aren't necessarily fact and they're not based on factual evidence. And it's just wherever I'm giving weight to certain things, and I just was giving a lot of weight to every single negative thing in my life, and I paid very, very little attention to all the good things. It takes a whole lot of retraining, which is so hard and really can really flatten you, but it's really worth it.
For sure. And often, like you've shared there, it does take therapy to do that amount of retraining, because you can look back on it now with the additional perspectives you've been able to explore this from and see, okay, that was really maladaptive. These things didn't add up. But at the time, that's one of the things that's the scariest to me about mental illness. It can warp your view so much. And then, like you were saying, you had then a bias towards anything that confirmed this negative outlook. That can feel good as well. Because you're like, well, at least I was right about this bad thing happening.
Yeah, exactly. It's wild. And I've been studying my master's in psychology recently because I wanted to just understand myself a bit more. And I've just wanted to like investigate as to why these things happen. And you're right. I think because it's opening my eyes to the certain things that could have helped at different times, and that things were just missed and glazed over, and from all kind of parts, there's no blame with anything, but also that there's no direct reason for feeling a certain way. There's not just one reason. It's not just the religious stuff and me feeling shit about my sexuality and ashamed of who I was. That wasn't the only reason I was depressed or anxious. It could have been, for instance, retrospectively, I've learned that there's a lot of anxiety in my family, psychosis and other different things. So genetics could play a part in it. Biology, because medications had such a good impact on me. It might have been that there's, you know, serotonin deficiencies somewhere. And so there's all these different things that are at play. We can't just say, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, because it's not always that simple, which I find quite comforting, because it almost takes the pressure off in a way, and kind of, as long as I'm doing okay now, it's not necessarily about finding the source. It's just that these different things could have happened, but it's just being aware that of those different things, that gives me comfort now.
Good. And it's great to hear you're finding that comfort in the complexity that for a lot of people, particularly early on in your journey, can be really terrifying. What do you mean there's not a single answer? What do you mean this pill won't fix everything? And I guess that is partly coming back to the stigma of, you know, the idea of happy pills and mental health being oversimplified. And I want to bring in Matthew as well to share a bit of your background.
So, yeah, hi, I'm Matthew. I think probably the earliest memories that I've got of it are probably around the time my mum and dad got divorced. So I was around 7 or 8 at the time. And I mean, even before that, I'd always been kind of like called a worrier, like sensitive. And as my mum and dad got divorced, I don't actually recall a lot of those years properly at the minute. I feel like I've got quite like a cloudy memory around all of it. And it was actually only about 2 or 3 years ago when I was in counselling that I recalled as a kid in junior school. I spent like a long time, a couple of years at least, going to like a school counsellor. And at the time, it was quite like revolutionary for the school to have it. It was called Quiet Place. It was an old classroom. They'd converted into like a rainforest room. Mm-hmm. And like you'd go and do like breathing exercises. And I'd kind of blanked that from my memory that I'd had that when I was younger. I'd also gone to Bernardo's as well as a child. And I think my family have never been big talkers. So it's only, similarly to Brendan, it's only kind of in recent years that I've maybe like learned how far back different things have gone in the family, whether that's like depression or a range of other bits, but it was just never really spoken about as to what it was or what was happening or pills were taken and that was it. And I don't think I've ever had depression as such, but I've always been dealing with anxiety in different ways. I think it was probably around the same time as the divorce, but I remember having a panic attack. And at the time, I had no idea what was happening. I was with my nan and I don't think she understood what was happening either. That was the only time I remember having a panic attack until about 2 years ago, which considering I'd say between the ages of around 12 and 20, I'd kind of for years and years and years just told myself that I was good and that like I'd dealt with everything that needed to be dealt with in my memory and in my mind. And it was in like a box and I was like, no, it's cool. Like it's in that box and it's ready to stay in that box. And I've moved on. I moved to London when I was 19. And I think physically and mentally, that was like a big sever for me to kind of being back home and also how I viewed myself. And it kind of tied in around, it was a couple of years before I came out. And I think those things combined allowed me to quite easily sever childhood to adulthood for me. And it wasn't until 2017, 2018 that something from childhood kind of was brought back into my life. I was given a heads up that it was going to come back. And that was, for me, the moment that that box that I'd kind of kept and said was dealt with exploded. There was like shit on the walls, on the floor, on the ceiling, like it was everywhere. And that then led me to go into, it was 2 years of counselling with Survivors UK. But up until that point, I'd kind of not thought of me as being a person that, you know, had anxiety anymore, would ever have to deal with any sort of poor mental health condition. Because I was like, well, I'm positive. I'm a positive person. I view things positively. I've kind of seen the way other people, other relatives have dealt with things and I don't want to be that person. So I'm going to go the opposite way and I'm going to kind of fight it almost. And obviously it doesn't work that way, which I learned the hard way. And yet spent 2 years worth of counselling, kind of unpicking things that I'd boxed up for so many years. But what I also learned then was that there was so many things that I connected that I didn't necessarily think were connected. So loss and grief and all of these things that I had not dealt with and didn't need to deal with because it wasn't like someone had physically died. But those conversations came up in counselling and it was, for me, quite refreshing because without realising that I'd put all of these other things into boxes to like not have to deal with the inevitable things, which is like much bigger than what my original purpose for counselling was for. But those 2 years were like really enlightening for me and kind of changed my whole perspective. And I mean, even now I've had a quite intense 6 months. And like my anxiety levels have been quite high. Like we've kind of said even before this interview, I think because it's like not within our constraints, I've been quite anxious about even speaking about this because as much as I think I've dealt with or deal with or continue to deal with, it's just still an ongoing journey for me. Mm-hmm. And I think it links within personal experiences as a child and growing up. And then also like the way that that's tied with me understanding who I am as a person and as a gay man, as a queer man. And I'm still learning to unpick those and work out what is what and how they both work together and separately.
And I think a lot of that can be when you've relied on pushing things down for so long, even when you reach that point where it does like break out of the box, like you described it as, you can still have that temptation because that's what you're used to. And to an extent, it felt like it was working, even though we could argue you were saving it up and it's all still been waiting for you. And then, it's all there. It's all like this big jumbled mess. And like, where do you start? Because you pull on what seems like a small thread and the whole thing just comes to you. And something else you mentioned there about not realizing because your symptoms were different to those around you that you might be dealing with some of the same things is interesting because what a lot of people don't know is that can be in family dynamics quite a common thing. and the research is still expanding about that, but potentially it's along the lines of there may be certain things. Let's take a condition like OCD as a good one to explain this with. If a parent has particular things that they check, particular compulsions, that may stress the child out, seeing that and seeing the stress that the adult goes through in those compulsions. And so even if they then end up developing OCD themselves, often they can end up with quite different compulsions because they have that built-in aversion to what they've seen. And so then they can end up going in what seems like quite an opposite direction.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, again, similarly, when I first moved to London, I was like, I can be the gay boy that I want to be and I can like do all of these things. And it wasn't until I was in counselling that I was realising that it was much deeper than that. And it wasn't just about me coming out. It was all of the family dynamics, which I think I tried to tell myself were not problems anymore, or I just ignored. And I was like, I don't need to deal with that. And then because of the way my brain had processed different things, it wasn't until years later. And even now there's times and I'm like, that happened. Forgot about that. So I say it's definitely an ongoing process for me, I think.
And do you sometimes feel like coming out is misrepresented in a way? Is this thing where you do it and there's the stress and often anxiety and other challenges leading up to that, and then it's done? And in reality, it's far more an ongoing process.
For me personally, when I knew I was gay, looking back on it super early, I can remember in like reception. So I kind of grew up knowing I was gay, but not understanding what that meant or what that looked like. And I left school and went to college with nobody else in my school. And it was in those first, say, 6 months of college, I met a load of new people. I was kind of online a lot. I spent a lot of time on Tumblr, like reading, seeing lots of different stuff. And it was around the Easter break. And for me, it kind of was like a really intense 2 weeks of just finding things to do to not have to think about it, because I could feel like the inevitable burst was coming. So I kind of was drinking a lot, going out a lot. It was Easter holidays. I was like mixing with people I shouldn't have been mixing with. It was really, really intense. And I ended up coming out to my mum kind of at the end of it, like, I can't do this anymore. I need to be the person to tell her. I prepare myself to be kicked out. And it was like a really stressful 2 weeks, especially, but a 6 months kind of. And then I spent 2 weeks hating her because I'd kind of built myself up for her having this huge reaction. And there was the opposite. I spent the night out. And like hadn't come home, and I ended up going home or going to a friend's like super early in the morning and coming out to both of them. And they were like, they were friends I'd met at college, and they were like, yeah, we got that. Like, I was like in tears. They were like, you really don't, like, I've got a gay uncle, I've got a lesbian auntie, like, it's no big deal. And I was like, no, I just need to know. And then I walked home to my mum and told my mum, and she thought I'd been locked up, and she was more concerned that I'd been locked up for doing something bad than what I told her. And like, that was kind of the reaction. She actually said to me kind of not long after that she thought, because I was like, are you sure you didn't know? Like, there were signs for years. And she was like, I just thought that because of seeing what had happened with me and your dad in the divorce, that you were just kind of really cautious of relationships, which for me was like quite an interesting thought in her mind that I've thought about ever since as well. Because when I think back, I like, there was signs. And then that's before then you kind of open your mind up to the bigger societal issues. Of just what it means to be queer.
It's fascinating, though, how separate family narratives can be, though, even in the same household. Mm. I'm glad to hear it went well with her, but I can equally see how it might have been a bit of an anti-climax in a way of like, oh, you're just okay about it? You're more interested in like whether or not I was locked up last night? So how does that contrast for you, Brendan?
Well, I came out a bit younger. I was 14. I'd obviously, like Matthew, known for ages. And what was different, I guess, was I had quite a good response initially. The family were really comforting. It was really sweet, like the first couple of days. And then I think over the years, it kind of became more of a point of anxiety for my parents. And so that's where the conversations between religion and, I guess, growing up in regional Britain, there's certain news that is more powerful in regional areas that sticks with people more. And so stories about HIV and all of the kind of doom and gloom, thanks to the media, was more in the forefront of their mind. So it just seemed like a bad decision to be gay or to, you know, choose to be gay, in inverted commas. So that's where it was a bit more difficult and complex as I was growing up into my, you know, early 20s. So I think in terms of your question about being like missold, I think it's always about just you saying it for the first time, I guess. That's the main thing. And less about the people that you're saying it to. is what I'd say to people anyway, is because you know it for yourself, but as soon as you say it to someone, it makes it real. And it doesn't always feel the way you think it's going to feel.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the biggest thing, I think. Mm-hmm. And whatever reaction you get, obviously, it's, some people can have incredibly awful reactions. Some can have amazing reactions. I think, yeah, as long as it's for you, that's the main thing, because you're in control of it always.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it, that really it's the power of you owning your truth. And although that is so scary and there is an element of irreversibility to making a statement like that, it does get easier with practice, and you get used to having the conversation and finding organic ways to bring it up rather than it feeling like the announcement it might be the first time.
Completely.
So Matthew, you touched on earlier getting past that stage, and then there's the whole, okay, now what about the rest of the world? How do I figure out how I fit beyond the family?
So I think I've kind of got, and I was thinking about this today before we recorded, I think I've got a slightly skewed version of this just because of my experience basically from uni. So I, thanks to Tumblr, thanks to all my years on Tumblr, I kind of felt like I was learning quite a lot and kind of...
You were like, the gays are so cool, they've got the best memes.
And I went from like nothing to like loads of things and resources within quite a short space of time. So I kind of, even though the coming out process itself for me was quite difficult, as I say, like the coming, like the 2 weeks especially, it all felt very rapid, kind of going from not knowing who I was to then all of a sudden being like, this is who I am and it's going to come out now and it needs to come out and everyone, that's it. And like, I felt confident within myself about it. It then was just the next step. But for the last 6 years, so at my dissertation at university, I wrote about internalized homophobia and racism, specifically within gay men on dating apps. So I've had like an interest in it since then, and then kind of skip a couple of years after uni, I've then gone to work in diversity and inclusion, and I now work at Tonic Housing, which is the UK's first LGBT retirement community. So it hasn't just been kind of a part of me and I've gone about life, like my day job and gay jobs, everything has been focused around LGBT topics to varying degrees for the last 5 years almost. I feel like I've just been moving at like a certain pace and not really reflected much on it. Which I think why this conversation in itself is quite interesting, because like as we're talking about it now, as I say, it's a constant journey.
Well, I got the kind of visual when you were describing it of almost you came out, you'd had so much build up to that, and then there was almost like a charge of like, okay, now I've got to do the most about this. And whilst that's very cool and empowering and the work you do is incredible, I can also see how that in itself doesn't quite give you a chance to breathe, because you went from not speaking about this to it being such a big part of your life.
Yeah.
I may come back to you about internalized homophobia, but I know, Brendan, that's something that you've had to navigate as well.
Oh, yeah, completely. I think the 6 years before I moved away after coming out really kind of messed with me and kind of melded my view of who I was. And I really struggled with who I was supposed to be, my identity, and including my sexuality. There was a lot of shame towards everything because of those themes as well. So for a long time, this has lasted for years. It really affected my intimacy capabilities, not the technical side, but it's affected a lot of my relationships and my ability to accept myself fully. And it's only been these real like late 20s years which I've really started to come into myself and actually love who I am. And I think what's helped with that, but in terms of like in the initial LGBTQ plus community and kind of coming into that, I never saw it as, you know how you see in the movies where they go to the gay club and it's like, oh, they're being seen for the first time and that's where they feel at home. That was never really that for me. I was always really scared in places like that. And in gay clubs, I'd feel really uncomfortable because I would feel not judged, but I'd feel lesser than because I didn't feel like I was the right kind of gay or the right type of person. And it really kind of messed with me because I was kind of like, well, who am I if I'm not the flamboyant gay boy? And who am I if I'm not a straight guy? Like, I really struggled with finding the nuance within my identity because, again, representation comes into our conversations a lot with our guests. I mean, even growing up, there was maybe 3 or 4 gay storylines in my lifetime before I moved away. from home. And they were always about, like, you know, always discreet and always, like, the gay guy getting beaten up and things like that. And so there was never the type of person I was anywhere. And so even within the community, if you're not seeing that, it's kind of like, well, where am I valid and where do I sit? And it can feed shame quite a lot. And it wasn't until, I guess, you know, therapy and starting to look more inward that I did begin to accept myself a lot more and kind of forgive myself for all of those feelings and the shame I had towards myself. And I think now I'm starting to make up for it by doing things like the podcast and opening myself up to more experiences. And the thing with anxiety is leaning into the fear can really help get out of the anxiety cycle. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to do that a bit more as well.
Brilliant. And yeah, hopefully talking about it so much and so eloquently like you do is really helping with that, because that's a great point around representation. And it's a real worry of mine that so often, being from, in fact, many minority communities, seems to be portrayed as interchangeable with trauma, as if that is innately what it is to be gay, is to be traumatized and to go through horrific things. And of course, it shouldn't be like that. And I can understand what that does in terms of representation on one hand, but sometimes it can feel like that's all we see. And then the is the implicit message of, you've got to fix this. You've got to figure this out amongst yourselves, as opposed to shining a light on, okay, who's causing a lot of this trauma? Where's the stigma in society? Where's the judgment? Where's the abuse you're receiving? Where's that coming from? And I remember thinking back that contrast for me growing up and being someone that dates people of all genders. I still have that today, where I crave happy TV that depicts LGBT experiences, because it's really hard to find, or you get glimpses of it among otherwise very turbulent storylines that are so often defined by that person's sexuality. Like, you are this kind of minority, and therefore this has to be your whole plot. And I really notice that contrast. You know, I could find happy straight people in the media all the time. And, you know, I still find myself looking on Netflix sometimes at the LGBT category and be like, where's something uplifting, please?
Yeah, it can be exhausting.
Yeah, exhausting is the right word. And we definitely need to, I think, move to the next stage. And I think a big part of that will be more creators working behind the scenes, you know, getting to write their own stories as well as star in them. And one thing that, Matthew, you got me thinking about with the schooling you described and the idea of internalized stigma is, did you find that then played into gender to an extent of being in potentially quite a macho environment? And, like, will this thing about me threaten my ability to move through this world in a comfortable way? Because it sounds like what Brendan describes was being denied a lot of comfort to explore who you are.
Yeah, definitely. And kind of, I remember, I can, like, vividly remember, out of the five of us, there was, like, two of us. And, like, say, obviously we were in quite, it was a big school. But there'd been numerous times where people from within my year would kind of be shouting stuff and saying stuff or throwing stuff or whatever. And then, like, on the side, they'd be like, oh, you know, we don't mean it to you. We know you're not gay. And, like, none of us said that we were or we're not. But they kind of read me as not being gay and, like, apologized for what they were doing, knowing it was wrong, thinking that I was, like, one of them almost. And obviously at that time I had zero confidence. None of us had confidence to be able to be like, well, actually, because the reality would have been that you'd have been pushed over, punched in the face, something was thrown at you, rumours had been thrown around. So when that's happening repetitively, that does then make you inside think. And it's something I often think about as well. I think if I went to a mixed school, would I have, like, again, quote unquote, turned out different? Because I don't know how much of that was kind of, like, knocked into me. And it's kind of, again, taken a lot of years to unpick. But even since moving to London, and not as much in recent years because I'm very open about my sexuality, but kind of when I was still at uni and was working in retail, the amount of times that people would kind of go, I'd say I'd been out somewhere. I used to work in a gay club as a photographer. So, like, when the weekend, what you've been on this weekend, conversation would come up, they'd be like, oh, it didn't have you down as a gay person, as in, like, as if it was a compliment. And it's quite a weird one, because as a younger person, you kind of would go, oh yeah, like, thanks, as if that was, like, a good thing. And it's as you kind of learn more about your own community and yourself that it turns from like a compliment to now I take that as like a low-key insult. I'm kind of like, well, and that's not just because it's a me, that's a much wider thing to kind of go to that person. Why are you saying that as that being a positive? Like, what would be wrong if I kind of was anything else right now? Why do you feel like you have to reaffirm or tell me that I'm like a quote-unquote good guy? It takes a lot of unpicking, because as well as like the direct conversations you have with people, similarly, like whenever you watch films or TV, like the queers always die, get ill, something tragic happens to them. So trying to like link that up with them building your own self-confidence amongst everything else, it's quite difficult to do those things at once.
And I think that speaks to how widespread and normalised a lot of this discrimination and stereotyping is, that it can feel insurmountable, particularly when you're young and you're just figuring yourself out, to challenge the entire narrative. And so it can feel like a get-out-of-jail-free card in a way, to then be like, oh, you're not like the others, because that seems achievable and changing people's minds doesn't. Mm-hmm. And that, I think you're right, it does make you wonder how things might have been different. And the way you've described bottling up your feelings and such is something that we talk about a lot when we talk about gender, and the way men are encouraged to man up and shut up, really, is what that's a synonym for, about their feelings. And I don't know, maybe with more girls in your school, that might have been different. I definitely, I think, benefited from that myself. I was always the friend that everyone talked to about feelings. And even sometimes in groups now, if I'm in a group of guys, particularly straight guys, really, I often get treated like the girl of the group. I'm like the one they look after and the one that they bring their issues to and like talk about feelings and dating and stuff like that with. And I think I'm just so used to and comfortable with that kind of moving in and out of androgyny, I describe it as, and like different people's perceptions of you make sense in this way, so this is how I'm going to interact. And I think that's a kind of freedom that we can deny people when we have this single story of what it is to be a man, or what it is to be any kind of person.
Yeah, I think it's something that we've, again, spoken about quite regularly, but even with like the work that I do and we do on the podcast, it's still so important to like always check yourself, because you can get quite comfortable and then realise like, oh, because we've all got like that level, a certain level of bias, regardless of what it's about. And even though it's nowhere near as extreme as maybe like 16-year-old me, there's still times and you kind of go, like, I've just had that thought, it just come up there. I'm going to unpick that a little bit, because obviously I don't want that thought, but that's what I'm being told I need to think. So I need to unpick that a little bit. And I think, I mean, the moral of my story is everything's just a constant journey. So I think it's just always about, acknowledging that no matter kind of how open I think you are about yourself and the world around us and our community, I think it's really good to kind of always be open to just having that humility to say, I'm going to reassess why I've just had that thought.
Mm-hmm. And something I wanted to, Danielle's basically being a preaching emoji in the background of the call. Brendan, one thing I wanted to ask you about as well, given we've talked a bit about coming out and your experience of figuring out what kind of gay you would be with all the stereotypes that exist, do you feel like there's an element of having to even justify your existence then, even in queer spaces, of like, I deserve to be here, and almost earn certain privileges in that space based on your behaviour or your appearance or confidence level, anything like that?
I don't think I'm at that point anymore, and I don't know what changed. Again, I think it was just becoming comfortable with myself that all of that stuff mattered less to me, and so it didn't really matter what anyone else perceived of me, because I was comfortable with who I was. So it's kind of like, I don't need to be seen here anymore, I don't need to be seen there, because it was, I think it was primarily getting to know who I was in the midst of everything. And although there was a lot of complication, it didn't matter that I ever found that person, because I was that person in the end. So it's kind of like learning to find myself, which is quite corny. I didn't have to go to Thailand to do it, but I managed to do it. And I think that's the most refreshing part. And although I know in terms of representation, it's always kind of like, when will I see myself on screen and things like that? And if I was to see someone like me on screen, it would be incredibly validating, but I don't crave it anymore. But it still doesn't mean that someone else isn't craving it. It's kind of like a weird, I don't know how to describe it, but that I wrote this, which is where bottoming stemmed from. I wrote this six-part TV series called Bottoming, which was me basically trying to laugh at all of my shit experiences and all of the bad things that happened to me. Because again, like what you're talking about in terms of TV and film and they're always being so dark and gloomy, I wanted laughter because I'd just been sad for so long. And so that was me kind of trying to piece together with humour the existence of me in a way. And so now it's more about, yeah, just being comfortable.
I like that. And it makes me think of the freedom in that, if we can start measuring ourselves instead by how we can be the best version of us as opposed to the comparison. But it's really difficult to do in our social media and celebrity-driven world. There's still, I think, a way to go in terms of representation, not only what we've discussed already, but also who gets to be the representative, and do they have to look a certain way, and do they have to follow, oftentimes it can be right down to a narrative, you know. And so I wonder that sometimes, would we hear more positive experiences of coming out if it weren't for the stereotypes of that being a bad and scary thing and that trauma link we talked about earlier? And would more people feel comfortable identifying with their sexuality if the only people they were seeing like them weren't, you know, stereotypically attractive people that were, you know, media ready and therefore so commonly pushed forward? And so what do you think about now in terms of what you'd like to see talking about mental health in terms of intersectionality?
I think primarily it's just as many conversations as possible, and I think saturation really can help in that way, especially when the stories have been, you know, neglected for so long or only certain stories have been brought forward. So just as many different narratives as possible, just so it does become a part of, yeah, common knowledge, common conversation, that it isn't, you know, something that you should mouth the word lesbian because you think it's weird. And it's like just getting past that point of subjects being taboo and hard to approach. And I think, like we've tried to do with the podcast, talking as honestly as possible, even if it does get a bit dark, but still adding, you know, the light and the humour where you can, really helps people also do that for themselves, which is what we've found listeners say with the podcast, and also taking conversations that we've had in the podcast as almost like a catalyst for them to talk to their friends as well, which has been amazing to hear. So again, yeah, just saturation for me, I think.
It is something that I think about a lot in terms of language, and it can be as simple as if you don't hear the conversation, you don't know how to have it. And so I love the work that you do in that you are having your specific conversation and you're bringing in loads of different voices so that people can go and hear a story similar to theirs. So they might know, you know, what to expect from having that conversation and how to have it. And I find that all the time with podcasts, no matter how long I do a mental health show, I still go listen to other people's and I think of things I never have before. And that can be scary when you're in the beginning stages to think, God, there's so much to unravel here, to figure life out, myself out, what the fuck's going on. But there is a certain point, I think, where it turns and it starts to get exciting and you become a bit of a knowledge whore and you just want to catch them all.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've both just kind of hit the nail on the head there. But Bobby, I know you mentioned before, like in terms of content creators, making the conversations accessible via like many, many more channels, whether that is a podcast, you know, Instagram videos, a YouTube video, like whatever form you take that in, I think just seeing it more obviously like breaks the stigma down for people. So we've had conversations and as Brendan said, they've kind of said, I want to use your podcast to kind of get a friend of mine that I know is struggling to open up a little bit more, but they've said they're not ready. And until people view mental health conversations as not like this enormous thing that has to be dealt with there and then, and it's kind of more of a longer term thing to enjoy, I guess, eventually, when you kind of get over the initial hurdles, you then begin to, like, as you say, you want to know more and understand more, whether it's about yourself or just more generally. And I think the more that we just see and hear and talk about that in different forms, make sure that people are not being left out and it's not just the same voices all the time, but yeah, just making sure that it's kind of accessible, I guess, is my main point with that. Because then the more people know about and talk about, the easier in one way things kind of become.
Yeah, And also the less pressure on these conversations, that it all becomes a lot more relaxed. I often think about it a little bit like a seesaw with the work that we do, that because there's so much stigma on one side, we have to really make sure to get our language right and shine a light on a whole range of voices. And I try and never lose an element of, I want it to be real conversations, like you're listening to insiders. I never want it to be like Mental Health for Beginners. There are other shows for that. But we get into the details here, because otherwise there can be a trap that you're forever explaining the same things. Yeah. And, you know, that very much applies to sexuality. You could spend your whole life answering the same questions. But for the audience, and indeed for you to grow, eventually you have to really get to the meat and have these conversations in depth and find all the nuances, because that's the stuff you really learn from. You could describe what it's like to be a certain sexuality a million times, but it's the really specific stuff that people are like, oh, I thought that was just me. You know, the generic stuff only goes so far.
And sometimes like that in itself does the job of maybe what you've anticipated being a load of work to do. All you need is someone else to go, or to hear someone else, and then you can go, okay. Like that makes, in my mind now, that makes sense, that was not just me. And it's like, I'm going to get the phrase wrong because I always get them wrong. But like, whatever the thing is about, like, you know, one thing halved or something is something shared. There's a phrase in there somewhere. But basically, like, the more it's kind of spread out and you go, oh, me as well. And then that person will say something similar. And then someone else goes, oh, okay, there's more of us than a thought. And actually, it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Which I think, yeah.
And you've just made, without even realizing, a perfect analogy for the importance of allyship as well, is like sharing out that way, you know, first empower the people that are dealing with something and then encourage the people around them, their networks, to kind of hold up the burden as well. And then if we're all doing it, if we're all playing a part, then, you know, hopefully that's the end of the stigma. And this show can just change to us just celebrating everyone being chill about mental health. No one has anything bad to say. Yeah. Could you imagine, like, a news report? No new issues, no sightings of stigma. And I'm so glad that you guys are along for this cause and doing such incredible work.
Yeah, and likewise. Oh,
thank you. Yeah, exactly.
Likewise, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And we'll wrap up there then. Is there any final messages you'd want to share if somebody is connecting to your stories and want to, you know, learn more about your experiences or anything that might have helped you that you'd recommend?
I mean, it's obviously sounding like a plug, but I would say we've kind of...
That's what I'm giving you the plug, to be fair.
Yeah. We have gone into depth. So I think we'd probably direct people to listen to Bottoming Podcast at Bottoming Pod on socials. And yeah, I think other than that, just kind of be open. I think that's the main important thing, because having that like willingness to listen and learn and speak when you're ready and able to speak, I think is a really powerful thing.
And I would add to that plug that it is a brilliant show and you've got so many really cool guests on, including Cherry Valentine, who's previously been here, and Rosie Jones, who I hope will be on our show sometime soonish as well. So yeah, well done.
Thank you very
Thanks
much.
So much.
All right, we'll wrap up there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.